Well, I'm here to start it out as question and answer. If you've got a question, now's your moment. You can ask me a question and I will try to deal with it. If you don't have a question for me, I might have a question for you. And now, tell you what, you guys been memorizing the Bible?
Yeah.
I bet you. Who can quote the first four verses of Psalms 166? Who can quote the first four words of Psalms 166? Nobody? Seriously?
Nobody.
Make a joyful noise. It's in both Psalms 166. Come on, people. All right. You got a question for me? Boy, you guys are dull.
Okay, I got one.
All righty.
Okay, so I was reading here in 1 Timothy 1, verses 8 through, I guess, 10, where it says, "But we know that the law is good if the man uses it lawfully, knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless, disobedient," and it gives this list of all these really bad people. And so what does it mean that the law isn't made for righteous people, but only for all the lawless, disobedient, ungodly, unholy, profane, murderers?
You mean, what does it mean that the law was not...
The law is not made for righteous people, only for these really bad people.
Well, other than that it means exactly that God did not make the law to try to limit righteous people in any way. Obviously, and that to me is obvious, almost not needed to be said.
Israel, you were righteous, you could just ignore the law?
Well, no, if you were righteous, you wouldn't ignore the law.
Okay, well, it says it's not made for the righteous.
That's a good point.
Okay.
All right, what does that mean? I'm going to stop asking you people for questions. Righteous people, the law, I'm not sure exactly what your question is, whether you're asking whether, who the law was over, because I think it was over everybody, including righteous people, but that it was not made to try to fix righteous people. Obviously, the same way Jesus says, "I didn't come to call the righteous, but I came to call sinners to repentance." The gospel is not really presented for righteous people. You could say the gospel is not made for righteous people. It's made for sinners.
And there is none righteous, no, not one.
Correct. And so this, you could say the same thing about the law. The law was not made for righteous people, it was made for sinners. And so if you're a sinner, you're under the law, obviously. But if you're asking whether or not there were anybody in the Old Testament that was not subject to the law, no, absolutely not. Everybody in the covenant of Moses was subject to the law. And those people who were not under the covenant of Moses, which would be not non-Jews, say like the ones out there that believed in the true God, but they were not circumcised, they did not follow the law of Moses. Those people were under the law that God had put in their heart. The law of doing right. The law of God's will, whatever God's will is. And if you were willing to do something you knew was not God's will, then that was breaking the law of God, even though it wasn't necessarily breaking the law of Moses. It wasn't the same thing. Those are different things. But if you're asking whether there was somebody not under the law of Moses or condemned by the law of Moses, I don't believe so. And I don't think that this verse here is to be used in order to make it out like the Christians are against law or against the idea of law. I had those arguments, and I even played with that thought as a younger Christian, that we're not under any law. We're just under the law of, we just do what seems right or what feels right. And I realized that I was wrong, because how many times the Bible tells us we are under the law of Christ. We're under the commandments of Christ. Jesus Christ said, "Go tell all those Gentiles to observe all things I have commanded you." So there's obviously a law even of Christ. But the law that we are not under is the law of Moses, that specific covenant law that he gave to the children of Israel for a specific purpose. That doesn't mean that anybody else out there was not under any law at all. They were under the law. Even the Jews will say that all Gentiles are under the Noahic covenant law. Whatever was commanded to Noah, they have to obey it. And that would include not having any other gods. It would include not killing people, because that's part of the Noahic covenant. But in my mind, Romans chapter 2 makes it even clearer, and that is that God put a law in everybody's heart. The law is written in their heart. You can tell by the fact that they condemn one another. They'll say, you did me wrong. That means they know there's a law that is wrong, and it's before God. You know that you're going to have to answer to God for that. Now, in my mind, that doesn't mean that the idea that there is no law is completely false. And the idea that nobody is that somebody, some people are exempt from the law, that's completely false. I don't see how that is. But the idea that it was not made for righteous people, obviously, it wasn't made for righteous people. It was made for sinners. And that's the reason why we had to have a law. We wouldn't have to have law to this day. Even in Texas, we wouldn't have to have traffic laws if people would just drive courteously, thinking about other people. But they don't. We have these laws because we have a tendency to be selfish. I was in Morelia one time, and the lights went out. We were at the meeting in our park, and the lights went out. All the electricity went out in the whole city, and so the traffic lights weren't working. And you would be amazed how you can get yourself in a jam because two people won't let the other person go. They're both there, stuck right there. And I got out. I walked up. We waited a long time. I walked up there and I saw the problem. And so I just went over there and said, you back up. And so he backed up and that guy went and I said, okay, you go and then you go. And it got to going. And when my car finally got up there, I got in and we drove off. But isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? The people need the rule. They need somebody because they're selfish. And if the one person had been kind and said, no, you go first, 14 other people would have zoomed right on through because he was kind and he didn't take his chance. They would not reciprocate, and that is just the way it is. But it can be trained, and in my mind, we are under the law of God at all times, from the time we're born, but not under the law of Moses. And
do you think this is a reference to the law of God and the law of Moses?
Well, boy, that's a good point. It could be the law of God. So it's even the law of God is really not made for righteous people. He wouldn't have to have a law for the righteous angels. He wouldn't have to have them have certain things they've got to fulfill if they're not tempted to do wrong. And maybe someday when we won't be tempted to do wrong, we'll have a different nature. Maybe there won't be any law for us. We would actually have the freedom to act however came to our nature because we will be like God. And that would be, man, that's a great thought. Anyway, thank you for that question. All right, now look, I've got questions if you guys want me to do it, but I want to open your. Oh, go ahead, sister.
Okay, so in the Bible, you read places that if you're not a believer, that you'll be thrown into the lake of fire. Well, I was reading in
I think that's saying the same thing. In my mind, I read it that's when you say you'll have your part in the lake of fire. That's your portion. That's going to be. Well, the lake of fire doesn't actually define what it is. All you're saying is it's a lake of fire. It's eternal. It has torment, whatever. But it doesn't tell us exactly how it works. I personally believe, because of all the emphasis on judgment in the Bible, I personally believe that hell, what we call hell, or the lake of fire, or the final disposition of people who are not in Christ, is going to be perfectly fair and righteous, so that It cannot just be one size fits all. Everybody goes and has the same exact thing. Now, I don't know how that works. I don't know how to explain how it's going to work, but I don't believe that old grandmother that died is going to have the same type of punishment as someone like Hitler. I don't believe it's going to be the same, because that would not be fair. And I think everybody in the world knows that would not be fair. And I think God goes to a lot of trouble to convince us that he's being righteous, that he's being fair. He even tells us that he's going to give us a chance to argue with him, to tell him our point of view. And so in my mind, he is putting himself out there saying, I'm going to be righteous. So in my mind, hell or the lake of fire is a place of precise judgment. So I do not believe when we finally get there and see it, it's going to be this imagination that we have that everybody is just screaming in torment exactly the same, and it doesn't matter what they did in their life. I don't think that's the way it is. And the Bible says it in those kind of, with those kind of things. It says they will have a greater damnation. Jesus says in Matthew 23:14, says, these people are going to have a greater damnation than these other people. And so in my mind, how can that be if it's all one, you know, what? So in my mind, that's what their part in the lake of fire. They're going to have their particular precise punishment in the lake of fire.
What was that in Matthew?
Matthew 23:14. Yeah, let's read it. It's an interesting one to me because the Jehovah's Witness Bible got rid of it. And so I tried to figure out why they would do that. What did they have against it? And maybe they were just being genuine, you know, genuinely believing in modern critical text theory. It says, woe unto you hypocrites. I'm 23:14 of Matthew. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. It's not the only place that talks about it, but that place says that, and Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in greater damnation. In their mind, it's all the same damnation as you die and you never resurrect. That's their idea. But the Bible says clearly everybody resurrects, even the wicked. And the Bible says clearly some people have a greater damnation than other people. All right, anybody else? Yes, sir.
Could you explain, I'm not quite sure on it, different ways, but what happened to the Lord when he died on the cross and he was buried and then the raising up again in Abraham's bosom and who he preached to? And he also said, don't touch me because I haven't ascended to the Father. How does all that...
Is that all you want to know? Or is there more that you would like to know while I'm at it? Okay, we do know that Jesus went to the heart of the earth. He said so. We do know that he went and preached to the spirits in prison. Said so. Says those are the ones that had to do with the flood. That's in 1 Peter. We do know that he led captivity captive. And we do know it says in Ephesians that he descended first and then he ascended leading captivity captive. It says that over there in Zechariah also, that he went to the pit where there is no water and took the captives. All right. And we do have the statement by Jesus about the rich man and Lazarus, and they were taken to the Abraham's bosom, and there's a great gulf between them, and some of them are consoled, some of them are comforted, and some of them are in torment, and that is the holding place where they are separated. So, we infer, we put all of that together, and we infer that before Jesus rose again from the dead, people who died went to the same place, but they were divided in between believers and unbelievers. Believers being with Abraham because he was the father of the faith. He's the father of the believers. And so those that were with Abraham were comforted. Those are the ones that had a personal relationship with God. They were comforted, and the others were tormented by their own wicked sin. Not a punishment torment, but it was a torment that was related to their own sin. And those people, and then Jesus, when he went down there, he preached. Now, I don't know if he preached on that side or if he just preached on this side, or I don't know how that works. It's apparently there might have been a third compartment where people who died before the flood or in the flood were there, because There is an argument about the word Tartarus. It's the only place it's used, but it's translated hell in our Bible. And they're thinking that that has to do with the angels that sinned or the people in Noah's time. And I don't know. That's getting into wild speculation as far as I'm concerned. We infer that this place called Abraham's bosom is also called paradise because Jesus said, "Today thou shalt be with me in paradise," to the thief on the cross. And paradise was down below, because we know Jesus went below. And then Paul says, "I was caught up into paradise in the third heaven." And that was after Jesus rose again from the dead. So we infer that that captivity taken captive is Jesus going into the earth, into the lower parts of the earth where the dead were kept, and preached, carried paradise, that side of hell, that side of Sheol, that Hebrew word for hell, that side of the pit that was comforted, he took those captive and he took them up to the heavens, and so paradise is now in heaven. Now, you'll get scholarly Protestants and you'll get scholarly Jehovah's Witnesses that will disagree with all of that. But I think you can safely disregard anything they have to say. Yes, sir.
Psalm 119, there are some names there, like for example between verses 8 and 9, has the name Baal.
Yes.
Psalm 119 has different names. What do they signify?
Those are the alphabet. That's the Hebrew alphabet. So like it starts off on Psalm 119, it says Aleph. Right. Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The second one is Beth. That corresponds to our A, B, C, D, and the Phoenicians had something similar, and the Greeks had something similar, and the Romans had something similar, and to this day we have something similar to that. They sort of correspond. In fact, we can transliterate Hebrew words into English, like Jesus or Joshua. Those are Hebrew words that have been transliterated by taking their letters and making them similar, putting our letters to them where they fit best. And there might be some differences in the way you might spell it, but that's what that is. All it is a way of dividing. Like if you had an outline and you would say A, B, C, D. Well, some of the psalmists, many people believe this Psalm 119 was written by David, even though it doesn't say that, but they believe it because David does this on other occasions where he alliterates his psalms where the very first letter is the letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So David will make a psalm and the first letter of the first verse is the letter Aleph. And then the second verse starts with the letter Beth and keeps on going down. But those there are the Hebrew alphabet. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Billy, I'm going through the reading. Billy, what is the Song of Psalms trying to teach us? Like, Song of Solomon? What is it, like, you know how Romans...
Is that all you want to know now?
Just general, really, as we go through it, 1 minute it's talking about a woman, and then the next minute it's talking about a man, and I understand it's God's love, but when it transfers from women to men, what are you...
There is one way you can kind of tell whether it's the man speaking or the woman speaking. One, in the English, they've divided it up. One says beloved and one says love. One says my love and one says my beloved. And those apparently point to which one is talking. I believe my love is the man speaking and my beloved is the woman speaking. And it talks about a relationship between a husband and a wife. And it elaborates on that relationship quite a bit. The Puritans used to take that as a way of us worshiping Christ, that is our worship to Christ. So that the sexual union in marriage is similar to worship in the sense of, in a spiritual sense. So that's the type of it. And so, when it gets into the sexual differences in the Song of Solomon, it's talking about our worshiping Christ. And some people will say that that's also prophetic, but I personally don't have any confidence in any kind of a prophecy that we'll get out of the Song of Solomon. I can't see it. I'm not sure about it. I find it interesting And I think there's probably good books out there that would explain a lot of it, and I would not argue with them. They don't really interest me. I don't get into that very much. I did try to study the book of Esther one time to try to figure out what its prophecy meant. And I got really deep into it, and I realized I could spend the next 100 years studying this book, and I will never be sure that I got anything right. So in my mind, prophecy is a danger. Prophecy is a problem in that you can put out a lot of effort and build a house of cards that one little thing changes and the whole thing falls down. It's a lot of effort for little reliability. And that's why when somebody says this thing that's happening has to do with Ezekiel 38 and that battle that happens and whatever, I just have no confidence whatsoever in that. They say Daniel 11 is about Antiochus, Epiphanes or whatever, and I have no idea about any of that. I'm afraid to go into that because it takes so much of my time and leaves me so little reliability. I can't be sure of anything. And when people talk about prophecy, they quite often really get out on a limb about what they're sure of, and I am not sure of it at all. In my mind, there's a few prophecies that are clear, crystal clear. Daniel 9:27 talks about the Messiah. That's crystal clear. We know what that prophecy is. Jesus' prophecies in Matthew 24, those are crystal clear. Or Luke 19, crystal clear. Some of the prophecies that are made by the apostles are crystal clear. But you get into Old Testament prophecies or trying to put prophetical meanings, even prophetical meanings to the parables, you've got to be careful with, because it's just not that clear. Now, if somebody goes to the trouble to show you how he comes to that conclusion, that's fine. But I really do not get into it. In my mind, the Song of Solomon is a love story that, first of all, justifies this modern chivalrous concept that comes from Christianity, that how a husband ought to love his wife and how a wife ought to love her husband. There ought to be a love between them. It ought to be that kind of a relationship. It's not this dominating type of relationship that so many other religions have, where the man is the dominant. It shows it very clear in the Song of Solomon that there is an equality of love between them. Not an equality of purpose, but an equality of love where the man is truly loving his wife and the wife is truly loving and reverencing her husband. And that dynamic is what is what you find in the New Testament, what Paul talks about, and what even Peter talks about, heirs together of the grace of life. And it puts away this idea of men saying, being dominating and this macho idea. That is not scriptural, and the Song of Solomon reinforces that. In fact, that's probably where these apostles like Paul, they got this idea of how you're supposed to treat your wife. And trust me, other religions, they don't treat their wives that way. It's not almost in any other culture do they treat their wives the way Solomon treated his beloved or his love or talk to him that way. It's a Christian thing. It's reinforced in the New Testament. In my mind, that's the value of the Song of Solomon. I don't want to get into what it might mean beyond that, because I will never be certain of it.
Okay.
All right, on that note, I was asked something. I was asked about polygamy. What do you think about polygamy? You know that it's entirely possible that the United States will make polygamy legal, because our Supreme Court is not to be trusted. And they've already made, two men marrying together, they made it forcefully legal now throughout all the states, because they just make up their minds.
Yeah.
And if they decide to make marriage with donkeys legal, they could do that too. They could just make up anything they want to make up. And they've lost their sense of where we come from and what we're standing for. And so somebody asked me, well, what about polygamy? Because the Bible actually talks about polygamy. And so I want you to think about it. Who was the first polygamist in the Bible? Do you remember? Say it again. Before the flood. It was one of, I think it was the seventh from Cain. Lamech. I don't think it was the brother of Tubal-Cain, but it was Lamech. He had two wives, and that's the first mention of polygamy in the Bible, and it's Cain's seed. Nobody on Noah's seed is mentioned as having two wives. What was the first mention of polygamy in after the flood? Not Noah. Noah had just one wife, and all of his children, they only got one wife to take on the ark with them. The first mention of polygamy after the flood is Abraham. Abraham. He had a servant girl and he took her as his second wife. And then of course after Sarah died, he took Keturah. So he had three wives, total, but two at the same time. And then of course Isaac only had one wife. And then, Jacob, he wound up having four wives, two wives and two servant girls that he took as wives. And, I don't know if you remember, but old Lamech, I mean not Lamech, Laban, which was Rebekah's brother, when Jacob tried to get away and he came and he made a covenant with Jacob and he made a point. He said, you're going to make this covenant with me and you're not going to take any other women besides my daughters. Now think about that from the standpoint of that father. He says, I don't want you taking other wives besides my daughters. Why? He was protecting his daughters. He was saying, there's a problem with polygamy. But it is regulated in the Bible. Did you know that in Deuteronomy it actually regulates polygamy? Let me see if I can find it. Look at Deuteronomy 21:15. Deuteronomy 21:15 says, if a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn, but he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. Now, the importance of this is that in the book of Deuteronomy, God regulated polygamy. Isn't that a problem? Isn't there a problem with that? We all know that there's some problems with polygamy. In fact, right there, that gives you a problem of polygamy. One's hated and one's loved. What's the point of having a wife that you hate? It just doesn't make sense. And it's a very common thing in cultures that have polygamy that they don't like any of their wives. They don't get along with any of them. And it makes perfect sense. And you had Rachel, the sisters, Rachel and Leah, fighting with each other over it. And then you have that Elkanah had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah, and they hated each other. They had a real problem with each other. And what is this? So we know there's a problem with polygamy. Why didn't God just condemn it from the start? Why didn't he be consistent from the start and condemn polygamy? Anybody have a speculation as to why God did not condemn polygamy outright? I can't hear you.
Because he wants to honor marriage. Because it's better to have them married than not have them married, I guess.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand the logic there. If
in other words, it's a marriage.
Yeah, I know, but why did God not condemn polygamy? Marrying more than one woman?
Because instead of having like a mistress, it's better to have another woman.
Oh, okay. That's one theory. I get it. In other words, don't sleep around, just marry a bunch. I get it. All right, I'm not committing to that one, all right? I saw you. Go ahead. So maybe it's the same thing?
Like, divorce wasn't ideal, but it was, he knew that it was going to be a part of the culture, so he regulated it.
That's a possibility. that God knows the hardness of our hearts, and so he just leaves it alone and lets them have it. But he regulates it. He actually goes to the trouble, and he also regulated divorce. So that's a possibility. Let me just give you my concept of it, because I know in the New Testament polygamy is spoken against. Remember over there in Matthew chapter 19, where they're asking Jesus about divorce, and he says, "And in the beginning it was not so." So he says Moses regulated divorce, but God did not do that at the beginning. Jesus making what God did at the beginning more important than what Moses did later. Right? That's Matthew chapter 19. And then over there in Mark, it says in the same parallel passage, let's go there, Mark chapter 10. I'm wanting you to consider this because people wonder, why isn't God consistent? Why does God allow divorce when he's against it? And then why does God allow polygamy when he's against it? And I'm going to prove to you here that he is against polygamy. He knows it's bad. He knows it's wrong. He knows you shouldn't do it. Here's the proof. Mark chapter 10, if you look at verse, let's go ahead and read verse 7. "For this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So then they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." That's what he said to the Pharisees. Now he gets into the house and they keep asking him about it. And he says something different, a little different here. He says, "And in the house his disciples asked him again of the same matter. And he saith unto them, Whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her." Pay attention to the words. You marry another, even after you've divorced your wife, you marry another, you commit adultery against your wife. This is a transformative concept. You don't find it anywhere else. Jesus made this statement that a man commits adultery against his wife that he divorced. Now, what that means is she has a right to have him exclusively to her. That's what Jesus said. He commits adultery against her. And then he puts it on the same. He says, "And if a woman shall put away her husband." Ha-ha. Did you know that a woman can put away her husband? That's not found in the Old Testament. That's not regulated by Moses. But Jesus makes it equal. He says a woman is not allowed to put away her husband. It says, "If a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she committeth adultery," obviously against her husband. Now, the reason why I say this is because this right here, this principle right here where Jesus puts the right of a woman to have a husband that's exclusively hers, that with that statement, he, in a sense, outlawed polygamy. And Christians ever since then have been against polygamy. That's been standard. But the Bible doesn't outright condemn polygamy. And that's the question. Why doesn't it just come? Why didn't God just start from the beginning, say, "Abraham sinned. He shouldn't have had more than one wife. And all these other people sinned. They shouldn't have had more than one wife. It's adultery. They're committing adultery." I think the reason why is very, very practical. And you know the story about in Judges over there about Benjamin. You remember when the tribe in Benjamin, Benjamin had that one city, Gibeah, and Gibeah had become very corrupt and wicked. And when they decided to go destroy the city of Gibeah, all the tribe of Benjamin decided to protect their city of Gibeah. And they fought and fought and fought until so many men were wiped out. So many men were wiped out that Benjamin was basically destroyed. And then the whole congregation felt bad because we've destroyed Benjamin. And then it says that they needed wives for the few Benjamite men. There weren't enough women for them. And I'm thinking, well, what? What are we talking about? Not enough women. They didn't kill all the women. They killed the men. But if you're going to rebuild a population that's decimated by war, you need lots of women. You realize that's the problem over there in China right now. They have a serious problem, and that is for 30 or 40 years, they only allowed couples to have one child, and they would abort the female children. They would abort the female babies. And so they have a great deal more men in China than they have women. Young men in China, many more than young women. And that's a problem because they are now in a tremendous population decline and there's not enough women to rebuild their population. That is happening right now in China. Here's the thing. If you want to build a population, you need lots of women. You don't need that many men. But you do need lots of women. I'm not trying to be coarse here, but this is the fact of the matter. And I'm thinking because of the way people were, sort of like what you said, the hardness of the heart, the way people are, you have all these wars, and the only way to rebuild is for a man to have more than one woman. And they could do that. And even in, I've got it all marked down, but I'm not going to go to it right now. I don't have enough time. But even in the prophecies, he says there's going to be such a destruction that it's going to happen. This is one of the prophecies. I believe it's in Isaiah, early on in Isaiah. But he says there's going to be such a destruction that seven women are going to find one man and say, we'll pay our own way. Just let us be your wives. And that way we can rebuild. That way we can do it. In other words, there was a practical value to polygamy in extenuating circumstances. And I think that's a very real possibility of why God did not outright condemn polygamy. But we know it's not his will. That's not what he wants because Jesus said a woman has a right to have an exclusive husband. She has that right because he can commit adultery against her. All right, did that answer your question, Brent? Brent, you're not in agreement?
No, I'm in agreement.
Oh, you're in agreement?
I'm just reminding her.
Reminding her, okay, I get it.
Well, also to point out, while God allowed it, there was always consequences.
There were
consequences of anybody who had a polygamist.
True, and there's still to this day. Wherever polygamy is practiced, it is a real problem. In our country, if this country goes down that direction because they've lost their minds, and they really have. Our nation has lost its mind. I know you think that Trump's got it back, but no, it's not true. Our nation has lost its mind, and who knows where they're going from now. But if they were to do that, it would be destructive. It would be destructive to civilization itself if they reinstate that horrible practice. However, God did not outright condemn it. He did say elders should have only one wife. He did say that. It's an ideal that God demands. And, but he did not say go out and, you know, if you've got more than one wife, get rid of them. He did not make it to that degree. I think God is a very practical God. And what you say about the hardness of the heart, that's probably part of it, where he's saying, I'm making less than ideal, adjustments, you know, for the benefit. But I would say polygamy is not Christian, it's not the ideal, and it's not God's will. And it ought to be illegal. All right. Anybody else have a question? Go ahead, brother.
Do you have a similar line of reasoning explaining why he regulates slavery? Because in a real simpler way, he lays down the laws for slavery.
All right, that's a very deep subject, and I have touched it a little bit before, but I'll just go over the high point of it. Listen, law restricts people. If you have no law, like it says in Judges, everybody did what was right in their own eyes, well then people just do whatever they do, and people have power and what have you, and you'll have things like slavery and oppression and all kinds of things, and then laws go in there and start adjusting these things. And that's what's happened in human history. Before there's these laws against slavery or the rights of man or all these things, you have a free-for-all. And so the powerful have the power. There was also the time when wars, you could not, there was no structure in cultures where they were similar in a way where you could have a war with rules. There were no rules, and wars were genocidal. You killed everybody in that tribe over there, or they're going to come back and kill you and your children. So that was the way that was. But the monetary value of selling slaves kept that genocide from happening. So God didn't make any rules in the beginning about slaves or anything, and it actually was a benefit. It was a benefit to the people that were conquered that they could be made slaves and sold into slavery rather than just being every one of them killed. That was a benefit. And as far as I'm concerned, if you can show that there was any benefit to slavery at all, benefit for the slave, not just the slave owner, if you can show there was a social benefit to it, well then you don't have any argument to say that it is universally always wrong. Now, American slavery was wrong in a lot of ways, and the Bible condemned American slavery very clearly. He said they're men stealers, and men stealers, the penalty was death. Even in the law of Moses, you couldn't steal a man and sell him, and that's what happened with American slavery, that transatlantic slave trade. You should know, though, that it wasn't just the transatlantic slave trade. Did you know that the United States fought a war against slavery before the Civil War? They fought the war. They called it the Barbary Wars, and they were those Barbary nations in North Africa were attacking ships and even attacking seacoast towns and taking Europeans as slaves to those Barbary places. They were selling them off into Africa and into the Middle East. And they say over a million of them were taken, and the United States went and fought a war. That was the first foreign war that the United States fought, and it was against the white slave trade, the slave trade of the Barbaries, the North African countries, stealing white people, Europeans, and making them slaves. And they didn't get most of those slaves back. They say over a million of them, and they were slaves, and their descendants are still there to this day. And so it's not just one way. It was all over the world, everywhere. God didn't make those laws because laws were incremental. He put more laws in place as we go. And at this point, at this juncture, we've got a lot of principles and laws that are in place. But it's not right to go back and say, why didn't they have the same understanding, the same laws? It's just not possible. It's not possible for them to have had the advantages that we have. But there's a lot more to say about that. In my mind, that's a deep subject, and I have touched on it before, probably in one of these question and answer subjects. I did touch on that. I don't know if you need more than that, but in my mind, slavery was wrong because it's men stealing, but slavery itself or servanthood itself is not wrong by itself, in itself, because there is a value. For example, in all these cultures where they don't have a strong social network, safety network, people starve. If you have three or four kids and they're starving, but you have the option of selling yourself into slavery, and you then can feed your children, well, that is an advantage to you becoming a servant. There's an advantage there. And if that's what they had, that was their only option, they would do it. I would do it. I would sell myself into slavery to keep my kids from starving. Anyway, I'm out of time. Next week. Come with a question if you don't want me to deal with mine.